Welcome to the May 2012 edition of the Law and Liberty podcast of the Calcedon Foundation. My name is Andrea Schwartz, and I will be your host. My guest today is a pastor of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, Reverend Dave Bush. Dave has a lot to share in terms of the impact Rush Dooney had on his thinking and how it's affected not only his preaching and his ministerial work at his church, but extra ministries that have come out of a worldview that says the Word of God applies to all areas of life and thought. Dave, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Andrea. It's great to be with you.
I met you a long time ago when we were having some meetings in the Bay Area where Dr. Rush Dooney would come down and spend a Friday evening just talking about things that he felt were important. And at that time, if I'm not mistaken, you were just about ready to go into seminary. Is that true?
Correct. Yeah, it was in 1995-ish, I think, that I was going to seminary in 1996. And I think it was the year before that I entered into your living room for a couple of times and was thoroughly intimidated by R.J. Rush Dooney. I remember he used me as his focal point. He just kind of for an hour stared at me while he lectured for an hour, took his eyes off of me for about 10 seconds the whole time. And it was my first exposure to Rush. And that was quite an intimidating hour session there.
So you had already decided to go to seminary. How did reading Rush's works or listening to him talk, did it change your orientation at all to what you were about to do?
Sadly, I was not really on board with Rush at that point. I was just beginning to read. I think I was reading No Other Standard by Greg Bahnsen. I hadn't even read Theonomy and Christian Ethics, but I wasn't sure whether I was on board with Rush. I was still sort of investigating things. And Gary Wagner had given me, you know, number one, challenged me to read some of Bahnsen. And he had given me Rush's Systematic Theology. His first essay in there, The Inescapability of Infallibility, jarred my thinking, really cemented in my mind. Everyone has a standard that they're working from. The question is, how reliable is that standard? And that began to open the door. And that, I think, followed upon that first entering into your living room and being exposed to Rush in person. But when I went to seminary in 1996, I still was very much a fledgling in terms of the views. I was intrigued. I saw the merit of the case and saw a lot of the valuable critiques that Bahnsen had offered against the critics of Theonomy. I was just never able to hear a solid refutation the whole time I was at seminary. And it was after graduating from seminary that I was actually freed up a little bit more in my time to start reading a little bit more and getting back to that fountain of grand theology that I'm far more convinced of today than I was even going into seminary.
So now you pastor Oak Hill Presbyterian Church, which is in the Sierra foothills of the Sierra Nevada.
Correct. I began here in January of 2002, so it's just been a little over a decade now.
What has intrigued me recently when we met up with each other again is the fact that you have really put legs to the idea that Christians are to engage the culture, and we're to engage the culture with a solid, orthodox, systematic theology. And that's one of the reasons, besides the fact that I like talking with you, that I thought it would be interesting for Calcedon people to hear the sorts of things that you're doing up there, not too far from Vallecito, Sonora, which people who don't know the geography of California don't know one city from another. Vallecito is a very small town next to a bunch of other bigger small towns, but I suppose in the area, Sonora is the biggest city close to Vallecito where Calcedon is. So tell us what sort of things you're doing in Sonora.
Well, in addition to the pastorate here at Oak Hill, I'm augmenting a number of other Orthodox Presbyterian churches. I'm actually serving presently on four different sessions. So I'm doing a lot of denominational work. And then I also volunteer as a chaplain with the Sonora Police Department and the Tuolumne County Sheriff's Office. Presently, we're trying to establish a prison ministry. So I preach at a prison on Sunday evenings. And then on Mondays, I do a worldview, 2 hours of teaching worldview. Right now, we've got about 50 prisoners that we're going through Calvin's Institutes. They're just eating it up out there. That's one other dimension that's very exciting right now. And then just recently, trying to get Christians involved in local politics and getting some city offices occupied by Christians. Helping my wife in small degree, homeschooling six children, trying to renovate an old Victorian home, and so have a few irons in the fire.
Okay, well, let's take some of these ministries one by one. Early on, when I found out that you volunteered as a chaplain with the Sheriff's Department, I remember commenting to you that puts you in a very good situation to talk to people who are hurting, talking to people who've just gotten some potentially bad news, and some people who've got on the wrong side of the law. Tell us a little bit about what it's like being a chaplain.
Well, the work that we do would be primarily doing death notifications for people who either live in the area and maybe next of kin for, you know, we've had auto accidents and stuff out of state even, and notify family members here. Sometimes we're on scene at accidents or crime scenes and dealing with family members who are being made aware of death in the family, or things that happen up at the ski area, if accidents happen up there and so forth. So wherever there may be a death in the county or in the city, the chaplains are called out to comfort family members and to try to be something of a distraction for the police officers to do their investigation of a potential crime scene, or to just be in a position where the officers are dealing with law enforcement. They don't enjoy the difficulty of dealing with someone who's being exposed to death of a loved one and the grief and all of the emotions that come up. They would rather do the law enforcement thing. So we kind of help diffuse those kinds of situations for the law enforcement agencies.
Now, I can imagine a lot of people listening saying, what an awful job having to call people or contact people and give them the bad news that a loved one has passed away. Mm-hmm. Yet, isn't it wonderful that a pastor, a minister of the gospel, is the one who gets to deliver that news? What kind of circumstances and opportunities have you found holding that position?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I wish there was more of a freedom to be able to speak the claims of Christ. There is such a radical difference between the way unbelievers process death and believers. And I wouldn't say it's just categoric, but it is so dramatically, you know, divided. We, you know, there are very emotional Christians and they're having a tough time because of the love bonds and their family members that die. And it really is very, very traumatic for them on occasion. And there are times when you have unbelievers that are just very sort of matter of fact and, okay, you know, he's dead, he's gone. I can deal with this. Thank you for coming out. I don't need you. Bye-bye. You know, by and large, the Christians have a context to put this in, and the sting of death has been removed. And I guess for me, to see unbelievers by vast majority who have no way of categorizing what is going on and processing that information, I mean, they're really are often crying out for the gospel. The sad thing is that we are sort of, our hands are tied, is that this is not to be our frontline ministry in the moment. We are there representing the sheriff's office or the police department. And so we function sort of as an officer and an aid to them. Now, where we can follow up, where we can call and see how people are doing, follow up on how things are progressing, ask if they have any concerns or questions about funeral homes and helping them to work through that stuff. And that's where you really find your ministry is not so much in that immediate moment. But I do know, you know, you just, every case is so dramatically different. You just really kind of fielding the situation and going with the flow, so to speak. I remember one where a couple of boys were in a car that had gone off a cliff, and they had died, and the mother had come back from was just coming back from dancing with her boyfriend under the influence of alcohol, and here I was in her living room ready to break the news that her two sons had died in an auto accident. And you know you're going to bring devastating news, and she was, you know, obviously an unbeliever. There were no elements of anything of Christ in the house. And when she gets the news, it's just, you know, foul-mouthed and throwing liquor bottles across the house and smashing them in the walls. And it's just so horrible. You just want to say something, let me help you to process this. And your hands are kind of tight at that point. But you can reach out afterwards. But by then, sometimes the moment is gone, and they don't want to listen, and it's just you're dealing with sinners who are struggling with life issues, and if there's a blindness, it's difficult to get through that blindness. But there have been times where we've had very hardened people, been able to give some resources to people about the Christian faith, and they sometimes depart. You never hear anything from them, but only the Lord knows how things may, you know, information may be digested and so forth.
Well, I think the important part is access. You've put yourself in a position where you have access. No, you're not going to be able to maybe do the fullest on what you can as an officer, because I've seen your picture on your website. You're actually in officer garb when you're doing that. But I think that the access is important. If more Christians put themselves into positions where they would have access to people who are hurting. I know many times I've been waiting in a waiting room in a hospital with people whose loved ones are in surgery, and it's a great place to hang out if what you want to do is just hold somebody's hand and just talk to them and let them share their concerns or whatever it is, because we live in a very isolated time where, you know, everybody has cell phones and Facebook pages, but people don't really have people who listen to them.
Yeah, you know, great point. It really is a ministry of presence. You know, oftentimes these people, they don't know what it is, but they are thankful that you're there on scene. We've had even just so many testimonies from officers that when the chaplain gets on the scene, all of a sudden they can breathe a sigh of relief because they know that the situation is going to be diffused because the chaplains bring something to the scenes where they're able to take the individual and to apply the love of Christ, though they don't often see that, but they know something's being applied to the situation that just diffuses the stress and the emotions and so forth. And so subtly there's, you know, that witness, the love of Christ and the presence of the chaplains but if you were to call people, if they call the individual or as the dispatchers are asking, would you like a chaplain to come out? 9 times out of 10, they say no. But when the chaplain goes out onto scene and the follow-up is, you know, was the chaplain a blessing? 9 out of 10, oh, I'm so thankful that the chaplain was there. So there's that subtle witness opportunity, but how many are really understanding the full implications? I guess I just wish it would be more explicit, but I'm very thankful that at least there is that ministry of presence there to comfort a hurting soul.
And I think that's an important point. I think, first of all, we have to start little. If after a while people asked for your card and said, can I get in touch with you again, they would already have contact. And I think so often people forget that ministry starts with a one-on-one relationship where someone feels that they can talk and you'll listen, as opposed to you have an agenda and I'm here to convert you.
Yeah, amen. That's just spot on.
You've now gone from a ministry where you don't have regular contact with people to a prison ministry. How did that develop?
There was nothing in my flesh that had any desire for prison ministry. When I got here, there was a gentleman who was going out to the prison, and he was actually teaching through Van Til at the time. And he used to speak about how great it was to be involved in this prison ministry. And I just thought, well, I am so thankful to God for you, because you know what? This is nothing about that that appeals to me. He ended up moving out of the area, and I, in my cowardice, decided to let that sort of die on the vine. I didn't want to take the time to get involved. I didn't want to spend the time and the energy and to be around these fearful guys that I had envisioned, these 6'4", 300-pound linebackers that were angry at the world. But I received a letter in the mail from a gentleman who was seeking for a reformed influence out at the prison. I read the letter. I prayed for this gentleman and for the ministry, and I promptly called the pastor down in Modesto and said, hey, how would you like to get involved in this ministry? He's about an hour away, where I'm about 15 minutes away from the prison. So anyhow, I received a second letter from this guy really saying, we want a distinctively reformed church out here. We're not looking for just a broad evangelical church. I'm thinking, well, there's no other reformed work in the area that I know of that would get involved here that, you know, other than, you know, Mark Rush Dooney down in Vallecito. I was thinking, well, you know, I need to pray about this. So I began a process of looking into what is required to volunteer out there. Went through the classes, and one by one, the doors opened up to where we went in on an every other Sunday basis. And I could not have been more surprised at what the prison ministry was like than I'm just so thankful that door was one that we, by faith, you know, looked into going through. And God, in his mercy, brought this wonderful ministry. The prisoners there just have such they know they're guilty. They understand sin. They understand guilt. And they are so thankful for forgiveness, to be treated as people. The guards just look down upon them so condescendingly that they are subhuman. And when you go in there with the love of Christ and you preach the reformed doctrines, they're like baby chicks with their mouth open, ready to receive the word. And there was such an invigorating dimension to the ministry there. When I preach in Sonora, I'm preaching to people that I love dearly. They're my family, but I'm laboring in the word to bring the word to them. And they're thankful. But it doesn't invigorate me. It's a sort of like an expenditure of energy. You're tired after that. When I go to the prison, I leave there just charged up, because there's just a different dynamic there. And so our every other Sunday about 6 months later became every Sunday. And then about 3 months after that, it became a every Sunday evening plus a Monday Bible study, worldview type influence. And it's just been a very, very exciting ministry. No problems. We've been there about 3.5 years now and have never had even the slightest incidents in the chapel. And we have 50 on our Monday work. And then on the Sundays, we have anywhere from 50 if we're meeting in the chapel. And then once a month, we get the gym and we can get about 100 people in there. And so on one week out of the month, we get a full 100 people. So we've got 50-ish on a waiting list to get into the program if we could just get the space. So it's just very, very exciting.
Now, is this prisoners alone or prisoners and their families? Are their families able to come to any services on Sunday?
No, this is just the prisoners.
Now, if it were your broad spectrum evangelicalism, I would expect that there would be some infusion, unfortunately, of some psychoanalysis and, you know, a 12-step type program, and you're not really responsible for what happened. But knowing you and knowing where you come from, you're not pulling punches with these people and giving them a way out, are you?
Correct. Yeah. No, they, I've told them I fear God more than I fear man, and that by the grace of God, because I was one who struggled with being a man pleaser. And I remember reading an Ed Welch book, When People Are Big and God Is Small, and that was so helpful in just really seeing who you needed to honor. But they love it. They appreciate the straightforwardness. We've come down very hard on things like homosexuality that is prevalent in the prison. And there are certainly people that I know I've stepped on toes when you bring the subject up. But you have to preach the whole counsel of God when it's comfortable, when it's easy, as well as when it's difficult. And I thank God that it's been that straightforward message that has challenged some of these people to actually repent of sins, even, you know, habitual sins in jail, because they see how you're addressing the other doctrines and treating those just as firmly and just as consistently and exegetically and so forth.
So when you mentioned that you had to go through a certain program to be able to get in, is that something that the prison itself runs to make sure that you're versed on prison protocols and things of that nature?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It was like a couple hours one evening where they go through all the rules of the prison and, you know, then kind of protocol in dealing with prisoners, familiarity, warnings of what female volunteers might run into with clothing and perfume and things like that, passing information and some of those concerns that the prison has to protect the volunteers from the prisoners and to recognize what the rules of the prison are.
Have you had any who have been part of your program who have actually left jail and stayed in touch with you?
Although the difficulty is, if you're a volunteer at the prison, you are not supposed to have contact with prisoners once they leave the program. But I have had a couple of phone calls from people who are excited to tell me that they're out and they're doing good and they're in church and so forth. So you have to kind of cut that short, sadly. But I think the heart was there, you know, that they were very thankful for, you know, some of those seeds that had been sown and wanted to share that they are living a victorious life and turning a course.
So this latest venture that you mentioned, endeavoring to get local people involved in local politics, that's not really a new idea amongst Christians. How are you approaching it to possibly make it more effective than a lot of attempts that have been going on for decades?
Yeah, this is really sort of grassroots. Right now, we're in the process of editing a letter to local pastors to consider praying and having a kind of a community-wide prayer on a 24/7 basis, and seeking to explore potential godly men who would desire to serve in these capacities, putting the feelers out, you know, just talking to friends that, you know, as I hear people, typically it comes in this way, somebody will start griping about political office. And so I sort of lovingly prod them. So what are you going to do about it? You know, and So are you ready to get involved and be a part of the solution? So far, I'm 3 for 3 in not being successful in that, but I'm going to keep trying. If people can identify the problems, you know, then they are people who potentially will be men who could bring solutions to these issues. That's what I'm looking for, somebody who has sound theology and understands the politics and is willing to step out in faith and reclaim the ground that has been surrendered to having our political system under the lordship of King Jesus.
Well, as someone who just told us all about how it took a number of proddings for you to take a trip down a road that would lead you to prison ministry, don't give up. You eventually said yes.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for spending time with us. I hope that this encourages other people the way it encourages me. We all have spheres of influence and we all have circumstances that we frequent a lot. You can do it as a minister. I can do it as a wife and mother and a volunteer. And I think the message that R.J. Rush Dooney really, through all the books and all the different approaches he took to the faith, whether it was the Institutes or his systematic theology, was that to reconstruct society on the basis of God's law is all about not doing something grandiose so much as doing something from where you are and taking what you know and applying it to the people and circumstances around you.
Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you something, Andrea, if your listeners would be encouraged by something that I have been comforted by, and that's the thought that the war is not won just purely by the aces. And we may never be an ace in this war, but if we can be a faithful foot soldier, we can contribute to the campaign. And we just minimize in our own minds, I think, what one individual could do. And I've been comforted by the thought that if God could accomplish a small task through Balaam's donkey, then he can use weak vessels like us.
Right. Listeners, I encourage you to pick up copies of the Systematic Theology. Actually, they're in two volumes. And as Dave mentioned, the first section alone is worth the price of the books because it really builds your faith and an understanding and an apologetic on the very basis of the fact that the Bible is inescapably God's infallible word to us. And as the rest of the sections proceed, it's really taking it step by step through a lot of the elements of the Westminster Confession of Faith as he covers all the areas that the Westminster covers, but in a very practical, down-to-earth Rush Dooney sort of way. Join us again next time for another edition of the Law and Liberty Podcast.